This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Standing against Israel's ongoing war crimes against and occupation of Gaza, we bring highlights of the World Can't Wait's extraordinary event, bringing together diverse voices of dissent. Join us and listen to people across the globe to hear how unjust and intolerable the occupation of Gaza is, and how impossible all that would be were it not backed by the U.S. government. Our speakers include Leila Al-Haddad, author of Gaza Mom, Ilan Pape, author of Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Frida Krista, filmmaker Where Should the Birds Fly, Josh Rubner, U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and Aris Mansour, Gazan journalist.
Frida Krista is a Palestinian editor and filmmaker born in Rafah City, Gaza. She has worked as a journalist, producing news stories and documentaries in the Gaza.
I'm sharing my time with a Palestinian, also young journalist from Gaza, who just left actually Rafah City and visiting the United States here. His name is Aris Mansour. I tried to communicate with my family during the attacks this time and what's happening in Rafah City, where most of my family lives. I had 7 cousins who were killed, and one of the cousins, he's very close to me and to my family. Everybody left home, and he said, "I'm not a coward, I'm not leaving. I'm not a member of Hamas, and our house is far from the border." He got killed, just going to his house on a motorcycle, and he was attacked with another cousin. Both of them were killed. Just 19 years old, just saying a sentence, "and I'm not a coward," killed him. I'm shocked when I first came to New York and saw how peaceful life could be. You go just out with your friends and have these moments of fun, and just like, I felt like we are totally distant. The experience that I had in Gaza, living in Rafah City, seeing all of that, made these years of my age too much. I was like, I can't really sit with a 20-year-old and just have a normal conversation. But then I thought, people really don't know. And people really don't know what exactly it feels to live in Gaza, how it feels to live in Rafah City. One day you are actually hanging with your friends, like my brother did. He says goodbye, and next day he hears that 4 of his best friends were bombed, and get in deep depression, and you try not to let him go into that moment. People actually don't really sometimes imagine those things. I woke up, my best friends are gone. These all keep building with the people in Gaza. I used to speak very peacefully when I come in front of people, and I love still to speak about peace, but there are moments when I saw these numbers of children were killed in Gaza, 430 out of almost 2,000. I couldn't come and just speak about the beautiful life that we still wish for. But seeing all of these kids slaughtered in the streets and these families, and talk to my family about my uncles and cousins' experience, I was so angry. I see people demonstrating in the streets, but I thought it wasn't enough, because people there need more. They need more voices to speak and hear. I know most people here are activists, but we need to reach these people who don't really know. These people need your voices as well as need us to speak about them. Now I'm handing the microphone to Aris Mansour, and he's from Rafah. He just came a few days ago to New York.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Frida to translate for me. So, إلي 5 أيام تقريبا واصل أمريكا والخمس أيام هذول طبعا مليئات بالكوابيس أو بالأحلام.
I'm here for 5 days, and since I came, I dream. I have nightmares since I arrived here. During the 30 days that Israel attacked Gaza, in this actually genocide that Israel committed against the Palestinians in Gaza, I don't even remember. I slept one day during these 30 days, 24 hours during the 30 days of war on Gaza. All I remember, the rockets and the planes that attacks in Gaza everywhere. There is a short story that I'm going to share with you today. There is a sentence that we say in Gaza: if you want to live, please stay away from children, because most of those who were attacked were children. I don't know how to tell you this.
جحيم يعني عبارة عن جحيم
it's a nightmare جحيم. It's hell
طيران بيضرب ما بيميز
it planes attack and they don't actually distinguish you walk in the street and a rocket attacks if you try to help people even you can't do it sometimes the only hospital in Rafah Abu Yusuf and Najjar they asked the hospital to evacuate Rafah became a city without a hospital or any kind of help something you can't imagine for me in my life I faced many wars I just want to remind you he's in his 20s so he faced many you know like in the last few years there were 6 wars in Gaza so he faced these lots
لأول مرة بشوف الجرائم بهيك شكل.
For the first time I see these attacks, the crimes escalated as much as this. The rockets that attacks people, they don't hit somebody just in the head or in his heart and then he dies. There is nothing.
أنا الآن بحكي معاكم وأنا مصدوم.
It's all exploded. Nothing from the body. I'm talking to you, but I'm still in a shock. I'm trying to recover from what I saw in Gaza in the last 30 days. But today I'm here and I saw this number of people. It gave me hope.
وشايف العدد الموجود هذا من الناس. وأنا بدي أختم في حاجة بسيطة بدي أحكيها.
I want to end with a simple sentence or.
رغم على الرغم من كل اللي بيعمله الاحتلال الإسرائيلي.
Despite what the occupation does.
وشو راح يعمل شو ما يعمل.
Despite whatever they do.
ما راح يحدث الابتسامة العريضة اللي على وجوه الشعب الفلسطيني.
They will not erase the Palestinian smile.
مش راح يدمروا الأمل تبعنا.
They will not destroy our hope. Thank you.
Layla El-Haddad is known as the Gaza Mom. She's a journalist because her husband is also a Palestinian, but one without the Israeli-administered right to enter Gaza. She's living here with him, and she's not able to be at home in Gaza with her dear family. She spoke to U.S. Congress people and mostly to their staffs about what was happening with Protective Edge.
Now on to the current situation, I'll close with that. We got some of the figures, 1,400 Palestinians killed, more than 55 families in their entirety, completely eviscerated. Families huddled together in their homes, children like my family members running for safety, and thousands maimed and traumatized. More disturbing are accounts we hear of UNRWA schools taking direct hits despite multiple reports to the Israelis of their location being given to the Israeli army. And of course, we heard about the power plant being bombed. And immediately after it was bombed, 24 hours later, the Gaza Twitterverse went silent. There were hundreds of eyewitnesses giving, you know, minute-by-minute accounts as young as 15 and 16 years old as they were being bombarded, as they were fleeing for safety, of what was happening. It went silent. And I'd like to just end with this account from my aunt, Dr. Muna Al-Farra, who is a physician and a women's and human rights activist in Gaza. And she was seeing a couple of young children in this tertiary care clinic being sent from the main hospital, which is flooded. And she gave this account to me in this email. She said, first I'll begin with the story of an unnamed child we call number 6. He was around 3 years and I had identifying stickers on his arm saying unknown and number 6. I was shocked. I immediately asked the nurses and ambulance drivers what his name was. I was told no one knew. They found him in a mass of destroyed houses. And he was the only survivor of his family. He had a head injury and wounds to other parts of his body. Immediately I asked, doesn't anyone remember where the house was? They said it was in the area where they found him. All the buildings were destroyed and mixed up with one another, and sometimes children are thrown from one area to another, so nobody knew where he lived. And then I realized, my aunt said, he's number 6. And that means there was 5 other unknown children before him, and many more children after him. Second is the story of Reem Ahmed, 6 years old. Reem arrived in the X-ray unit. She has a name also, and she used to have a family. She was the only surviving member. She lost her parents and all of her brothers and sisters, and she was injured in the head. These are just 2 small examples of what is being done in Gaza. Now, we hear a lot of talk of Israel's need to defend itself, its right to defend itself, of Israel's security. But you know, Israel's security can never be derived from imprisoning, bombarding, systematically incarcerating, demolishing houses and repressing the indigenous population of Palestine. We're talking about Gaza today, but Gaza is just a symbol of the broader Palestinian struggle. It is, in the words of Mahmoud Darwish, a brutal lesson, a pilot project. And I'll end with this. UNRWA spokesperson Chris Guinness said on Twitter that after the Israeli attacks on the first UN school, there's been two others since this tweet, UN schools turned shelters using US military aid. We should all hang our heads in shame, but that from this shame should come justice and dignity, and I should add security, freedom, and accountability for the Palestinian people.
Josh Rubner is the author of Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. He is the policy director of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation.
We've heard a lot of powerful testimony from our Palestinian friends about the terrible crimes which are being committed against the Palestinian people, most specifically in the Gaza Strip. And we have much to be outraged by, but we have as much to be outraged by the actions of our government. We need to lay the blame where it belongs for the perpetuation of Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people, and that is at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and at Capitol Hill. It is inconceivable that Israel would be allowed to get away with what it gets away with without the nearly unconditional military, diplomatic, and political support that we provide to it. Now, what we've seen from the Obama administration for the month of these massacres and war crimes has been a continuation of a policy which has backed this brutal and illegal collective punishment in the form of a blockade on the Gaza Strip for now 8 years. A policy which has provided nearly unlimited support for Israel's illegal military occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, for 47 years. A policy which has provided nearly unlimited support for Israel perpetuating and maintaining the rotten fruits of its ethnic cleansing of 1948 and the dispossession of the Palestinian people from their indigenous home. The State Department has said that Israel is acting in self-defense. When a journalist at a daily State Department briefing questioned whether Palestinians might actually also have the right of self-defense, the State Department said that it was, quote, offensive to consider that Palestinians might have the right of self-defense. John Kerry called Israel's actions appropriate and legitimate. The United States was the only country in the entire world to vote against the UN Human Rights Council establishing a commission of inquiry which would look into the actions not only of Israel, but of Hamas as well. According to the Obama administration, it was one-sided and unbalanced. President Obama has allowed Israel to draw from U.S. stockpiles of weapons in Israel the same 120-millimeter artillery shells and 40-millimeter grenade launchers that Israel has been using to such devastating effect to commit these war crimes. We have provided Israel with both the weapons to successfully defend themselves against these flimsy Palestinian rockets in the form of Iron Dome, which according to the Israeli military has a 90% success rate. Israelis face virtually no danger from these rockets. Yet, we provide Israel more than $3.1 billion every year to provide Israel, since 2000, more than 800 million weapons and rounds of ammunition. The F-16 fighter jets, the Apache helicopter gunships, the Hellfire missiles, the Joint Direct Attack munitions, the naval gunboats, all of these are paid for by us, making us directly complicit in these crimes. Look, the Obama administration has now frozen the supply of Hellfire missiles to Israel, and agreed to scrutinize future weapons transfers at the highest level of the administration. Now, the reason why is because of the fact that hundreds of thousands have been out on the street protesting vigorously our support for Israel's war crimes against the Palestinians. It is because we are being visible and we will not be silenced. This is how things change. The fact that more and more of U.S. public opinion is with us, especially the youth. What do we do to build upon this? Number one, we have to speak about Palestine everywhere. We need to talk about it in our schools. We need to talk about it in our labor unions. We need to talk about it in our mosques. We need to talk about it in our churches. And yeah, we need to talk about it in our synagogues as well. Israel's war crimes against the Palestinian people are wrong because war crimes are war crimes and they are illegal. So we need to engage our public officials and tell them enough is enough. If we shrug our shoulders and we give up, if we say the Israel lobby is too strong and too powerful, then what's the dynamic that we've created? We've created a dynamic where the only people who are members of Congress are hearing from are people who are in the Israel lobby. I think you all know how to step up the tactics and step up the tactics we need to do. When we did this congressional briefing, we actually had so many people attend that we actually ran two briefings in a row to accommodate everyone who wanted to hear about what was actually going on in Gaza. So we've got to work on our elected officials, and we've got our work cut out for us, that's for sure. But the other thing we need to do is we need to engage in campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Israel, it has to pay a price. Otherwise, there's no motivation on its part to change these brutal policies. And we make it pay a price by engaging in cultural boycotts. We make it pay a price through academic boycotts. We make it pay a price when our institutions divest their funds, often from U.S. corporations, which are profiteering off of Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. Because the reality, when you look at the end of apartheid in South Africa, it wasn't until white South African society had paid that price, had become international pariahs, that policy change was possible. I'm convinced that we are seeing that very same process occur right now. And I know for certain that it's only after Israel ends its separate and unequal apartheid policies toward the Palestinian people can we begin to even think about having a just and lasting peace.
Ilan Pappe, an Israeli historian and activist. He is a professor with the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. His book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, is essential and definitive reading. He's just made this message for us today.
I would like to provide a historical context for the present carnage in Gaza. In April and May this year, it became clear that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank decided to abandon, at least temporarily, its full support for the failed diplomatic process based on the Oslo Accord principles, instead of participating again in a futile round of talks. The Palestinian Authority has decided to try and form once more a unity government with Hamas, and decided to go unilaterally to the United Nations and other international organizations to demand their attention and their reference to the situation in Palestine on the basis of a human rights and civil rights agenda, and judge Israel according to these yardsticks, and not to accept the paradigm of parity that claims that there are two conflicting parties that need international mediation, but rather an oppressed party that needs world's assistance. This initiative was regarded by Israel as a very dangerous development. And when Israel is faced with dangerous developments in its eyes, It uses all its military might, and we know it is the strongest military power in the Middle East. It is not using it against conventional armies or non-conventional armies, but against mainly civilian population that has very little means to defend itself. Israel was looking for a pretext to launch its initiative to destroy these new moves and ploys by the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The pretext was the abduction and killing of three young settlers by local Palestinian youth who were infuriated by a systematic killing of young Palestinians by the Israeli army in the month of April and May 2014. This local initiative had nothing to do with the Hamas, but it was enough for Israel to launch a military assault on the Hamas in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The political leadership and activists of the Hamas in the West Bank were arrested, including members of parliament, ministers, and political prisoners who were released in the famous Shalit exchange deal. Israel waited for a Hamas reaction. A mild Hamas reaction came with the firing of a few rockets that did not hurt anyone, but this was enough for Israel to take the initiative further and use military might that is aimed to defeat conventional armies of states and not an urban society crammed into one of the world's most densely populated area at the size of a middle city in the United States. The West Bank was tainted by Israel by dividing it into two basic parts. There are parts of the West Bank that Israel annexes as we speak and would eventually impose the Israeli law on. This is, of course, strengthened by a constant stream of Jewish settlers ever since 67 into those parts. There were parts of the West Bank which are densely populated by the Palestinians that Israel does not wish to control directly. They could be called a Palestinian state should the Palestinian resign to live in open prison Bantustans forever. This kind of an arrangement was tried in the Gaza Strip, but this did not work. The Gaza Strip is too small. It is locked between Egypt and Israel, and there was no way that the wardens of the jail of Gaza, namely the settlers, could live peacefully when the resistance against them started in earnest. And thus, Ariel Sharon decided to take out the wardens, the settlers, seal the Gaza Strip, and bombard it with all of Israel's might whenever the people of Gaza would not accept the ghettoization that was imposed upon them ever since the settlers in 2005 were taken out. A ghettoization that includes starvation through checking how many calories a Gazan person needs in order to just barely survive, the prohibition of any basic material for normal existence, and of course a total sealing of the strip from any connection with the world. So the Hamas are trying to resist this ghettoization, and with every resistance Israel employs more power. Power that every Israeli general knows can only result in a massive killing of civilian population. This exponential killing of civilians can only be described as an act of ethnic cleansing. This is a crime against humanity and a genocidal policy. There's very little hope for an Israeli change of mind. And when the people in that area remind the Israelis that they are human beings and they would not sit quietly lying down while they are incrementally genocided and strangulated, then Israel accelerates its killing machine and the obvious results are unfolding in front of our eyes as we speak. What can be done to stop it? First of all, one has to accept the ideology that lies behind these policies. And the ideology is the same one that informed the Zionist movement in the late 19th century. Israel is a state that wants, that craves to take over as much of historical Palestine as possible and to have in it as few Palestinians as possible. At present, they mean three basic policies: maintaining an apartheid policy inside Israel against the Palestinian minority there, dividing the West Bank into two basic parts of a Jewish and a Palestinian West Bank, enclaving the Palestinians in Bantustans and slowly transferring them out of the Jewish areas of the West Bank, and finally trying to silence Gaza and send it into oblivion by sieging it and ghettoizing it with the hope that Israel could forget about it. The fact that the Gazans are not willing to be forgotten pushes Israel to a more extreme means of trying to send Gaza into historical oblivion. And the means are military, and they are financed by your government in the United States, and many of them are produced by the United States. Recognizing this ideology is a racist ideology should be at the heart of the conversation about a solution to the problem in Israel and Palestine. Declaring Zionism as an ideology akin to the ideology that informed the apartheid state in South Africa, and using the same means the international community employed against apartheid South Africa in the case of Israel, can open the way for the discussion of a regime change in Israel that would allow both Israelis and Palestinians not to be governed by an ideology that benefits the one but destroys the other. This will open the door for looking for a different ideological framework, a genuine democratic ideology. With this kind of regime intact, the land between the Mediterranean and the sea could be a haven for both the settler communities, now in its third generation, and the indigenous native people of Palestine, who should be joined by all those who were expelled in 1948 during the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe. Accepting the BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanction, as the main means for the international community to pressure Israel into a regime change is the only way forward for solving this question by creating an ODS with the help of the BDS, one democratic state with the help of boycott, divestment, sanction, with an authentic Palestinian leadership that would lead us into a much better future.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.